You're listening to The Songwriter's Diary. This episode features Balmohan Shingade. Balmohan is a writer, curator, community researcher, and a performer of Indian classical music. Welcome to The Songwriter's Diary.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here and speak with you.
Yeah, this is an exciting episode for me because I know nothing about Indian classical music, and I thought that this would be a really good opportunity to learn from you and also for other people to also hear what you do as well.
That's wonderful. You know, it's a great opportunity for me to share my love for this music, my enthusiasm for it. There's a wealth of community practitioners here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and it's just such a joyous music that I've been part of basically all my life. So can't wait to talk more about it.
Talk a little bit about your journey with Indian classical music, and correct me if I'm wrong, is it Hindustani?
That's right. So that's a great place to begin with, because we can talk about Indian classical music, and in India, in South Asia, there are two classical forms of music. So the South Indian form is called Carnatic music, and the North Indian form, which is not only in India, but also in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Nepal. So the northern part of the subcontinent is North Indian classical music, also known as Hindustani classical music or Shastriya Sangeet. My journey with it, you know, really began, I would say the turning point was when I was 17 years old. But the journey actually begins when I was 6 years old, 7 years old, when my mum and dad introduced me to Carnatic music, the South Indian classical form. I was born and I was being raised in Hyderabad, which is in South India. And I had the really wonderful opportunity to begin learning that classical form of music. But we migrated to Aotearoa when I was 10 years old. So there was a little bit of a break. There were some teachers in New Zealand that I really got a lot out of. And eventually what happened, and why I bring up my 17 years of age as a turning point, was I was sent to India. My mom and dad.
Oh, so from New Zealand, you were sent to India again?
That's right, yeah. Mm. And it was basically my mom and dad kind of saying, you know, this is your OE, go figure yourself out. And basically the opportunity was to find myself a guru. And guru is esteemed teacher. So through mutual friends and teachers in New Zealand, I was introduced to my teacher, Rajendra Kandalgaonkar, who is an esteemed Hindustani classical practitioner. I was learning Hindustani classical music in the traditional guru-shishya parampara way, which basically means teacher, student, or master, disciple, that sort of form of apprenticeship. This was happening in Pune, in Maharashtra. I was living in a basically one-bedroom apartment, which was totally sparse. There was nothing in the apartment. And so I, you know, had basically a sheet on the ground to make my bed, was there for 70 days, had a tiffin box that I got from a family that I went to who made the lunches and dinners, and you know, carried the tiffin box back and ate it. And it was just the cycle, the 70-day intensive cycle, where I was daily practicing for 6 hours or whatever, and going for walks in this new city for me, having the pleasure really of going deeply into this music. I continue this teaching and learning online now. And before COVID, used to go back to India regularly to continue my learning with my teacher.
Yeah. So what's the significance of the 70 days?
Oh, it just happened to be the entire summer period.
Ah, okay.
So it was before I started my first year at university and after I'd finished my high school.
For someone who's never had a guru before, the way I understand it, what a guru is sort of like a mentor. Is that correct?
That's really right. Yeah. It's mentor, and it's a really close connection that you develop with your teacher. And maybe we can contrast it by looking at how music education is done in institutions, where you are there for a period of time learning for, let's say, a course that gets you either a diploma or degree, if we contrast that with this model, it's infinite. The commitment is as long as you're learning. And so you're ongoing, you're exploring together. And eventually it happens that the student is exploring things that the teacher then benefits from. And there's this sort of exchange that happens. I'm not up to that stage yet, but I can see how there's more and more autonomy that is given over to the student to explore various ideas and share them and workshop them together. And also you become close with families and community, and you get to be seen as part of that particular musical community.
One thing I was interested in finding out is you shared a video with me. You were playing the tanpura.
That's right.
Are you able to tell us a little bit about your journey learning the tanpura? You know, how old you were when you first, I'm guessing your parents bought you tanpura?
That's right. Yeah. Well, you know, tanpura is a really interesting instrument. It is like the drone in other forms of music. My tanpura only has four strings, and that's pretty common. And it is fretless, and it only plays four notes over and over again. So it's not a very difficult instrument to learn. Actually, you can learn it within a day, because all you have to learn is the strumming or the picking pattern, right? The reason for that, in Indian classical music, you've got a ground, and that ground is what you develop from, and the tanpura gives you that ground. It plays your dominant note. Musically speaking, it plays your note one, or your do in the do re mi fa system, or it plays your key, you know, the main note. And so that is happening in the background, and that is what a musician, whether she is doing singing or she's playing sarangi or whatever the instrument might be, it's developing on top of that. The most difficult thing about tanpura is actually sitting with it for 2-3 hours on end. It's actually not hard on your fingers, it's hard on your knees. And maybe I'll show you how the tanpura sounds. What you can hear is that there's four notes, and see if you can identify the four notes, and it just goes in the background gently like this. So the idea is that once you have that ground, then you think about, or you perform the raga. And raga is a core concept in Indian classical music. And this is where we really get to learn what Indian classical music is about. So raga is a concept that describes a melodic framework. So Indian classical music is all improvised. You know, 95% of it, Hindustani classical music, is improvised. You have a composition, and then you're improvising using that composition, using the words of that composition. And what are you improvising? Well, I like to explain it like this. Raga is an environment. It's a mood. It's an atmosphere. It's a feel. It's a vibe. And imagine that each raga is like a landscape. There's many, many different landscapes. Now, a landscape over centuries changes, just like if you imagine, you know, here we are in Tamaki Makaurau, and it's a particular landscape with a particular vibe. You know, it has its environmental uniqueness. It has its many, many maunga mountains. You know, so it's identifiable. It's an isthmus. And so everybody who's experiencing Tamaki Makaurau is experiencing the same landscape, but actually they're experiencing it in a unique way. So if I have a visitor from out of town coming in, I might want to show them the bits that I really like. Let me show you my neighborhood, and let's walk to Mongafo, Mount Eden, because, you know, I really treasure this mountain. I want to show you this place. And from here, we can see the entire landscape. So this is an analogy to describe raga. A melodic framework is like landscapes, and there are many. There's like, popularly, there's more than 300, but then that in the popular music, there's even more than that. And each is unique. But because Hindustani is improvised music. Each performer will show you their version of the landscape. You know, it's a unique journey. And as a performer, you walk through that landscape with your audience and build a kind of atmosphere to dwell within.
Something that you talked about that I think is probably quite different to Western classical music is notated. There isn't a lot of improvisation.
In Indian classical music, it's primarily an oral music. It is transmitted orally. There are notation systems, but they're just kind of reference. We have two main ones called Paluskar and Bhatkhande systems of notation, but they're like scaffolding. Once you've got the building, the scaffolding goes away. So it's treated like that. You are not meant to be reliant on the notation. They're meant to allow you to build the structure that you want to build. And then once that's done, notation has to be put away. So one of the other differences is that the music's developed in such a different way across the different parts of the world. And what we get to see is that in Western music, there's this great complexity around harmonic development, notes that are layered on top of each other. And you get to see this from the chanting, Gregorian chanting, and then how it kind of develops into this quite complex chordal sort of music. In Indian classical music, the emphasis went in melodic development. So we don't really have, in the classical forms, of course we do in the popular forms, but in the classical forms, we don't really have chordal development. What happened for us is that melodic development became so complex. You have not just tones and semitones, but you've got quarter tones, you've got microtones. So because Hindustani classical music went into melodic development, you get to see how raga is really shaped by lines of melody. And it's quite complex. And actually, what I've seen is that people who are coming from improvised traditions from other parts of the world gravitate to Indian classical music, like the jazz tradition has embraced Indian classical music tradition because of the improvised emphasis. So there's lots of collaboration between jazz and Indian classical music because they both understand the sort of improvised basis.
Say you're on the stage and you're playing the tanpura.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you communicate with other musicians or other instruments, sort of where you're going musically? Is that something that you just feed off each other, or are they certain cues that you have?
Beautiful. That's a wonderful question.
I don't know
question.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense, because let's explore what you'd normally find on a musical stage. And it depends on the format. So if I was performing and if it's a performance of a melodic instrument, so voice in my case, but it could be sitar, sarangi, sarod, santur. So these are the kind of, and bansuri, there's many, but these are the kind of melodic instruments. So they are either bowed or plucked or woodwind instruments, you know. What you'd find is that they are developing the raga, they're developing the mood and the atmosphere. And on either side, you might find that there's a percussionist. And the percussionist in Hindustani music is a tabla player, usually, or a pakawaj player, which is also a rhythmic instrument. It's a barrel, and it's a drum on either side. And it's the kind of predecessor to the tabla, as far as the development of musical instrument goes. And then on the other hand, you might have harmonium or sarangi, and they are shadow instruments. That's how I like to describe them anyway. Let's imagine a concert, and you know, I'd encourage the listeners to go check out Indian classical music and see the instrumentation as it's being presented to you. You might find that this is what's happening, is that the sarangi player or the santur player or the singer is developing the music, they're developing the raga, and you've got this shadow instrument, whether it's harmonium or sarangi, offering counter melodies, sometimes following along the melody, sometimes offering up little challenges or little alternatives supporting the musician. So they're always kind of breathing life into the music by shadowing the primary performer. And then you've got the real rock on the other side, which is the rhythm accompaniment and dialogue with the primary musician. They might choose, depending on the composition or the raga, like a 12-beat rhythm cycle or a 16-beat rhythm cycle. And what happens afterwards is really a dialogue between the musicians. You know, a phrase might be turned into a response from the tabla player and then turned back into a response from the singer. So what I love about this music is every time that you're on the stage, no two performances are ever alike. You might be singing raga yaman, let's say, which is an evening raga, usually done around the time of a sunset. But each yaman that I've heard being performed, each yaman that I've had the opportunity to perform, is always so different because your mood as a musician is different, your accompanist's mood, it's different, the audience is different, and the day is different. So the dialoguing between the musicians also is different. So that's what I love about this music. It's always fresh and it's always living and breathing kind of a music.
And because you're improvising most of the time, what does a practice session sound like or look like?
That's a great question. I try to have a daily practice session. I have the good fortune of knowing, I guess, some of the practices that develop you as a musician. You know, the kind of things that you do as scales practice, breath practice, tone shaping, all of these things we do. But then there's also the music practice, which is how can I actually get inside this raga? You know, I'm not feeling it. Something's not quite right. Let me explore the melody in this way. Oh, actually, that worked a little bit better. So it's quite a creative process. Every time you sit down for a practice session, once you've done your rigorous training, the practicing of raga, you have the structure within which you're exploring every time. And maybe, you know, I didn't explain the raga from a musical point of view, so maybe I should just touch on that a little bit. So I described raga as a melodic framework. And what I mean by that is that it consists of a certain set of rules that have to translate into a scale. So let's look at raga yaman. Yaman is a raga that consists of a sharp four.
So is raga sort of like a scale or a mode?
Technically speaking, that comes into it. So you build from the scale and you build from the mode into this abstract concept of mood or atmosphere or environment or landscape. Sometimes one single scale is used across three or four different ragas because one scale might ask you, actually, it's the same scale, but don't emphasize those notes, emphasize only these ones. And that changes the mood quite entirely. There's a raga called Marwa, Sohini. You know, these ragas actually share the same notes, but their mood is quite different because of their different emphasis, the different time of day they're sung, the different rules. So if we look at raga yaman, from a musical point of view, it's got a sharp four. Some of the rules are that note one and five, when you're ascending, you don't use. And when you're descending, you include them again. A scale then begins to sound like this. So the note that is one here is sa. And raga yaman, the ascending descending scale would look like ni re ga ma da ni sa sa ni dha pa ma ga re sa. And the combination of notes that you might develop from raga yaman, they try and keep in mind this rule of minimizing the emphasis on one and five. So a phrase might be Ma ma ga ga ma dha ma ga ga ma dha ma dha ne ne dha pa ma dha pa ma re ga re ne re ga sa. So I'm using the equivalent in our music of do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, which is, it's just in the major scale, it's sa, re, ga, ma, pa, da, ni, sa, sa, ni, da, pa, ma, ga, re, sa. And some ragas have unique stories, unique mythologies that come with them. So one of the stories that I could share with you is Bilas Khani Todi. That is the name of a raga. Now, Bilas Khani Todi is named after a person named Bilas Khan, who was the son of Mia Tansen. So Mia Tansen is a really important figure of Hindustani classical music. The story goes that when he passed away, his son Bilas Khan was mourning the death of his father, and he was really upset and wanting to sing one of Mia Tansen's favorite ragas, Todi. And as he was singing this, in his grief, he mucked up the notes. He got it all wrong. As it happened, the corpse of Mia Tansen, it is said, that raised a finger in approval of this new melody. And so the story goes that now we have a new raga called Bilas Khani, so Bilas Khan's version of Todi. These stories, you know, they're kind of mythologies. They are, you know, all through our music, and the music is made richer all the more for it. One of the beautiful things about Hindustani classical music is that it's not a communal music. That's to say, it's a pluralistic music. It's practiced by Hindu people, Muslim people, Sikh people, Christian, Parsis, Jews, and non-religious people, you know. It's practiced by a whole segment of the population, and that's its beauty. And it's been patroned by various people through its time. You know, one of the narratives goes that it's an ancient music, and one of the things that it does for me is that actually, yes, while it has an old and mixed and plural tradition, it's not just an ancient tradition, it's a contemporary tradition that is being performed, innovated upon, developed in the present day. There's more and more innovation that happens in this music and in this thinking. So with its mixed history, that's something to really celebrate. Like the founder of our school within Hindustani classical music. So there are many different schools, right? Like there are many different modes of thought. Our one is Kirana Gharana, and it's named after a place. And the founder of our school, his name is Abdul Karim Khan. He had a really beautiful, very, very high, very resonant, but quite a sort of alto soprano style kind of a voice. And one of the teachings that I have often heard repeated in our school of thought is, you know, music, it's not in the complexity of patterns and notes and all of those things. A single piece of sound, one note that you can produce in the most kind of authentic and present sort of way, that's music. And how can we sing our music with that sort of respect for each note? I think it's a really powerful story, isn't it? Because for me, when I then begin to improvise, I think about, well, how can I respect this note? You know, and how can I develop the second note based upon my respect for this one? There's a concept called badat, which means growing. We use this concept to grow the music one note at a time. An example in Yaman, if I can share, might look like we sing just focusing on a single note. Re, re, And that sense of wanting to think about each note, how it is accompanied by another note, and how you can develop each note at a time is quite central to how, at least, I have been taught to think about this music.
That's a reminder that music is just more about how you feel and being present in the moment. And like you're saying, appreciating the note that you're playing and appreciating the next, and how the previous note you just played is how you got to the second note.
Beautiful. Yeah, that's really right. I think, you know, you as a musician, and I wonder if you have this experience where when you're playing or singing with that sort of a sense, you kind of get lost in it and you experience a kind of presence because you're totally attentive to the production of sound, the production of respect through sound. And that's something that has helped me in my journey through Indian classical music.
Yeah. I just recently started getting vocal lessons again. And the other night, because I've been having vocal lessons on Zoom, and I brought a song for my vocal tutor to go through with me. And I sang the song and I was trying to sing it exactly like the artist.
Mm-hmm.
And my vocal tutor said to me, "Hey, have you thought of just singing this song the way you want to sing it, the way you would sing it?" And when I started singing the song the way my heart wanted to sing it, it just sounded beautiful. And I just felt like I didn't feel any tension.
Yes.
I wasn't thinking about, okay, I'm going to sing a high note soon. Okay, what's my voice going to do? Like, is my voice going to crack? I wasn't thinking. I was just singing and just being present. And although it's not the same, everything you just said reminded me and reassured me to really be present in the music that you're expressing or singing out.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I think that's so right, because one of the cul-de-sacs, you know, if I can put it like that, that we go into in this journey sometimes is copying, you know, is emulating. And that sort of defeats the purpose of trying to think about what you contribute to that song that you're covering, that piece of music that you might be wanting to express. I mean, this is really interesting from a Hindustani classical perspective because, you know, at the time that you're on the stage as a performer, you're both the performer and the composer at the same time. You know, you're writing the music as you're performing it. And so memorizing certain lines that other people have done in the past often doesn't help unless it's totally integrated and it becomes your own and you've reshaped it as something that you've thought through.
The first instrument that I learned was classical piano.
Right.
And I was learning for years. I remember one day I thought to myself, I don't think I actually know how to play the piano. I just know how to read music.
Right. Yes.
If I sit on the piano, I am more comfortable having sheet music.
Right.
And for me, I think I can't really play the piano. I'm just reading music.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, I think that sheet music definitely restricts me. And that's why I was drawn to the first time I ever listened to Hindustani music or classical Indian music was I saw a video by, I can't remember her name, but Norah Jones's sister.
Yes, yeah, Anushka Shankar.
Yes, I'm sure you've seen that video. That was my first introduction to Hindustani music. And let me know if that wasn't Hindustani music.
No, that's exactly the music. And it's a beautiful lineage of practitioners that she belongs with.
Yeah, so I think that was the moment where I was like, I don't think I'm making music. I'm not present. I'm as a pianist, I'm not present. I'm not free. I'm not playing and I'm not exploring. I'm just reading.
Yeah. You know, there's a really interesting story with Anushka Shankar's father and Norah Jones's father, you know, Ravi Shankar, which touches on what you're describing about presence, about music's role in sort of gathering attention, like people's focus. So the story goes like this. It was around the time of Woodstock Festival in the United States. And he was a sitar player, a really illustrious sitar player from India. He was touring the world. And at this particular festival, there's video documentation. It's brilliant. What he was doing is, you know, spending 5 minutes or so just tuning his instrument, just making sure everything was, you know, as it should be. And then he stopped. And suddenly, at the moment that he stopped, the whole crowd that was gathered around just had the most uproarious applause. They just gave this the biggest, biggest applause. Because for them, they were responding to what felt like music. And partly, it was just Ravi Shankar being able to hold people's attention, even tuning his sitar. And he says something afterwards. He says something like, you know, I hope you will like what comes afterwards as much as you liked me tuning my sitar. You know? And I think it's such a brilliant story because from the point of view of the listener at this festival, you don't really know what to expect, but you're hanging off every single sound, even if it is the sound of an instrument being tuned. And with that sort of presence can be brought about with music, I think it's really powerful. And I love the story because it describes, you know, the kind of power of presence that we're kind of talking about.